Let's talk wine with Red Nose Wine, Davis Road, Clonmel, rednosewine.com, 052 618 29.
And Gary Gubbins is with me, bearing gifts as ever from Red Nose Wines. You're going to talk to us today about, you're always very anxious to team up the wine with food, and today it's roast beef.
Yes, well, as we're families are gathering or starting to gather, be they coming from Australia or if they're just coming down to Clonmel from Thurles or Cashel, there's people meeting and sitting down, and I think roast beef is a classic. I know it's traditionally a British dish, but we probably have the best beef in the world at Tipperary. So I said I might as well, as people are coming gathering around in groups, try and just have a look at a couple of wines that might suit.
Now, it's a very hearty meat, it's a very hearty meal. So how do you sort of look at wine where that is concerned?
Yeah, I think there's two things to consider. When you have a roast, is it a sirloin roast, which is a much leaner style, or maybe is it a rib roast with a bit of fat going through it? I think that's important. And then the other thing is, as the French say, the cuisson. How is it cooked? Do you want it dripping in blood?
No. Boy, do we disagree on this one.
We do, right. We can't agree on everything, Fran. We both like Van Morrison.
Yeah, there is that always. But I like mine really, really well cooked. In fact, if I go into a restaurant, I ask them for the burnt bits, and I know you're deeply offended by that, but you like it rare?
Yeah, no, each to their own. To thine own self be true, Hamlet said.
Indeed, yeah.
No, I like it bloody. I used to like it well done, and I might have told you this before. I was lucky enough to live in Paris for a number of years when I was in my 20s, and I got so sick of handing back the steak to get it redone, and I know they were spitting it in the kitchen, so I just said, come on. And I worked from the outside in, because obviously the middle bit often is the most rare.
Yeah.
And I just sometimes, maybe the first few times I would leave the middle bit, which, right. And then my wife, girlfriend at the time, wife now, she would just say, ha ha, and she would just, that'll do me. So she, right. She always liked it rare. But it's over time. I think it's a bit like Guinness. I hate my first pint of Guinness,
yeah.
But it's an acquired taste.
Yeah. Anyway, I'll believe
we,
you.
We'll agree to disagree.
We'll agree to disagree. But you're looking at both aspects of this where your wines are concerned, aren't you?
Yes. So I think the rarer the meat, and especially if there's a bit of fat going through it, I think it will lend itself better to a wine with higher tannin and higher levels of alcohol. So that kind of bigger, younger, more robust wine that hasn't maybe had a bit of maturity. Because especially when we're talking about Bordeaux, I think myself they're better when they have a bit of age on them. They work. So I think the two wines we're going to taste today is a Crianza Rioja, which is, well, it's young, it's 2014, but that's by law. It has to be minimum a year in oak and a year in bottle before you can call it a Crianza. But that's still in Rioja terms pretty young. That's loads of fruit, loads of energy. So I think that would go well with your rarer bit. And then I also have an older Bordeaux. I was in Bordeaux a couple of weeks ago, and all the fruits of my trip have come in yesterday. So the place is awash with Bordeaux. And one of them is an Haut Médoc. So it's predominantly Merlot, which is rare in the Haut Médoc. It tends to be more Cabernet, but this has about 40% Cabernet. But this has a bit of age on it. It's a more delicate wine. I think that would go well with
the
better done meat. Although the French still would, they're better done and our better done are very, very different.
I can imagine. All right. Tell me about the Rioja, first of all, because we tend to have Catholic taste with Rioja. It tends to be the Festinos or, you know, the really well-known brands and stuff. But there's an awful lot more out there with Rioja.
Rioja is like even the styles of Rioja. There's what's called Hoven, no oak, which are real fruity young summer wines. They're great because they tend to be lower alcohol. Tempranillo gives it its name. It's early ripening. That's what it means. Yeah. So these are wines that are loads of fruit. And then you have a Roble, about 4 to 6 months oak. Then you have a Crianza, which is a minimum 12. The one we're tasting is 14 months in oak, and then it must have a year laid down as well. And then you have Reserva, which is 18 months plus, and then 24 months or over, you have a Grand Reserva. And that's what you see in the Faustinos. I think they come and they number them 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. I'm not sure is one the most oak or the least oak. I don't know, I'll be honest with you.
Yeah, I think as you go up, it's better anyway.
Then there's more oak, because one thing is true, oak equals money. So when you like a big, rich, oakier wine, like your Chateauneuf du Pape, you're paying a lot of time for two things, oak and the time. Because those wines can't be released young. They have to spend, firstly, two, maybe two, 3 years, Barolo, 7 years, in oak. Before they're released. They don't spend 7 years in oak, but they spend 7 years before they're allowed to be, a Barolo is allowed to be released.
All right, and of course you pay for that, needless to say. What part does the sauce or the gravy have? How does that influence the wine? Or does it? Does it play any part?
Yeah, I think when you're choosing, because we're talking about well done or rare, but if you douse it with loads of a really rich sauce, you're kind of taking away a lot of that anyway. So I personally love a little bit of gravy, but I don't have a whole lot. But sometimes you'll see these kind of the newfangled the jus, where they, you know, the extraction and sort of much richer. And I think those kind of wines are better with New World wines, like, you know, the Shirazes and something with maybe 14.5% alcohol, a big bang, because you need. We always talk when we talk about balancing the weight of the wine with the weight of the food. So if you're going to put a load of flavour into the sauce, you need to match it on the wine. I think myself, something like gravy isn't as big and flavoursome as some of those, you know, more like a pepper sauce or something.
Right, right.
So I think you can do something there with more delicate.
Sometimes wine, of course, is included in some of those sauces as well.
It is, and when they reduce it gets much more intense flavours. And so you're fighting against that flavour with the wine. So it's, you know, it's if you have a light flurry with a big rich sauce, you will not taste the flurry. And it's the same principle with white. Why do you have white wine with that delicate white with a steak? You just won't taste it. You might as well drink the apple juice.
and I'd agree with that too. All right, so what are we going to taste first?
I think we'll start with the older, more delicate wine. So this is the Bordeaux, and this is a drier style. And I have a club tasting I'm doing tonight, and I had to prepare a cheese platter. So we're tasting some nice Barolos and things. So I said I stole a little bit off the plate for us.
If
you wanted to try it, I have some Cashel Blue, I have some Brie, I have some Camembert, I have some red mature cheddar, and I have some
very good.
Cheddar.
Because I'm not a cheese person, you would you recommend something with the Rioja for me?
What we're drinking now is the Bordeaux.
Oh, are we? Oh, sorry, yeah. I beg your pardon. Okay.
I think myself, the Bordeaux, something like the Brie or the Camembert, either of these two would go quite well.
The Brie?
That's the Brie.
This is a tough job we have at 11:10 in the morning.
And I took the liberty of drinking half this bottle for you last night to make sure it breathed sufficiently.
That's very good of you, and thank you for that. It goes unappreciated.
No, it's my pleasure. So the wine should lift the flavours of the cheese. And that's a delicate, dry wine. It needs food.
Whatever about the cheese, the wine is gorgeous.
That's a pretty good one. It's Omedoc. It's from, actually, it's owned. I was only looking at it last, taking a picture for Instagram last night, and it's owned by Domaines Carlsberg. I don't know if they're the same family, but I said if Carlsberg made wine, it would probably be that.
Probably. But there's a hell of an aftertaste on that wine.
It's quite long. It's been open as well. It's 2012, which is quite young for a Bordeaux.
That is just gorgeous. I mean, I could drink that on its own as well. It's light enough for that, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. But I think the dryness of it, for me, it would tire out my palate.
Yeah, it's lovely. What is this? Because I never fully got it. I have to admit the relationship with wine and cheese.
I guess there's a lot of different wines have a lot of different textures, a lot of different flavors. Some are strong, some are dry, some are sweet, some are, you know, all sorts. And cheese tends to have that different array of flavors as well. And I think it's just almost a shortcut to being able to. The whole idea of it is that they complement each other. So it's like the right food with the right wine. It's just the wine should be elevated. And the food should be elevated, and they shouldn't clash. It should be a marriage. It should be. I know I'm talking a bit airy fairy now about it, but it's the idea is that it's a symbiosis, and the flavors complement each other. So if you have a tannic wine with a fatty food, the tannins will cut through the fat, and they will take the harshness out of the food and take the harshness out of the wine. In principle.
Yeah, it's very interesting. So, okay, the wine that we're drinking now is called?
That wine is called Aix de la Rivaux.
Okay.
From Omedoc. And it's basically a medium-bodied wine, firm acidity for me, well-balanced, quite subtle and quite delicate.
Gorgeous with roast beef.
Perfect with roast beef. That little bit, especially if you have that little bit of fat in the roast beef, that will just, that those tannins that are drying out your mouth a bit, they will just cut through that lovely.
Can I be my usual crass self and ask you, how much is that?
We're in December now, so I wasn't going to bring anything too cheap. $19.99.
$19.99.
For that. So that's in, but that's from a quite a well-known estate in Bordeaux.
Right.
Now, in saying that, we have Bordeaux's from $12.99. And we have an absolute cracking wine. I visited the estate 3 weeks ago, 2010, which is a stellar vintage from Chateau Lagnut in Saint-Emilion Grand Cru. Anyone who wants to treat somebody for Christmas or themselves, it's about 50 quid a bottle. It is divine.
Is it indeed?
So, but anyway, right. We have it at 12.
Well, that Bordeaux would do very nicely if anybody wants to send me in gifts. it will be well appreciated. So are we going to have a look at the Rioja?
We're going to have a look at the Rioja. So I think knowing you at this stage I think you'll prefer this one.
Do you think so?
I could be wrong. It has more oak. It has more, a bit more bang. It has a bit more fruit. But I could be wrong.
It's not a typical Rioja sort of.
Yeah, this is a.
From it, is it?
It's from a domain called Carlos Serres. He was actually originally a Frenchman who, when the phylloxera came into France, he moved to Spain because a lot of people don't realise Rioja and Bordeaux, their soil types are very, very similar. So even though you don't really grow Cabernet and Merlot in there, but Tempranillo, they're not unlike each other.
Right.
So
that is very nice too. It really is. And that would go with a more rare.
So you can see it's a bit fruitier. It's a bit more alcohol in it.
Funnily enough, I mean, it's lovely, but I would prefer the Bordeaux on this occasion.
Well, the Bordeaux is only twice the price, though. But if you try it with the cheese, I think this one.
And what piece of cheese is?
That's the Cashel Bleu. I think the Cashel Bleu might work with it, but I'm not sure. I haven't tried it. I think Cashel Bleu works with everything, but I'm biased.
It's gorgeous. The Cashel Bleu is fantastic, isn't it?
It's mature as well. Actually, does go. I wasn't sure it would. So the saltiness of the Cashel Bleu.
Gorgeous. So that Rioja is...
That Rioja is part of our Christmas special. So that's the good news. Normally $14.99 as part of our multi-buys. It's down to $11.99 for Christmas. And that is for a Rioja Crianza with 14 months in oak, a year laid down. That's pretty good.
And Crianza means it's a premium wine, is it?
Crianza is the fact that it has a minimum of 12 months in oak and 12 months in bottle before it's released.
Okay.
Crianza is the step before Reserva.
Okay.
And then Reserva is the step before Grand Reserva. But if you have a Grand Reserva Rioja, it is it's quite overpowering. So I wouldn't always, they really are, and they need a lot of age. So I think myself, best bang for buck in Rioja is that Crianza stage.
All right, very good. Now, just to repeat to people, because I know we always get people, when you're gone, to say, would you give us the name of those wines again? Right, the Bordeaux is called?
The Bordeaux is called Le Extra Larivaux. Think of the X wine from Bordeaux.
Okay, very good. And the Rioja?
It's Carlos Serra's Crianza. But the good news is, these wines, this Friday, Saturday and Sunday, and next Friday and Saturday and Sunday, normally we have a kind of a night where we have our portfolio tasting and open a lot of our wines. We're doing that over a course of 3 weekends, and it's a drop-in. Just come in from Friday, Saturday, and we're open Sunday from 2 o'clock now. We will have these wines and probably another 15 open, and you can go and taste before you buy this Christmas.
All right, okay, so sounds great.
And can I give one last plug?
Of course you can,
The Rotary Club, actually, down in the Regal Centre, this Larry O'Keefe's are organising it. We're coming in with them with ourselves and Pet Planet and Tangled Yarns. And basically, any money spent in the Regal Centre this weekend, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, there's a contribution being made to the Rotary Club. I wasn't involved in the planning, so Mary O'Keefe has all of the details.
She was in with us to tell us about it.
All about it, but that's happening from this Friday. So it's a good time. Not only will you save a bit of money for Christmas, you'll raise a bit of money as well.
All right. Well, listen, that's fantastic. Will you deal with the turkey and ham and what might suit with that next time?
I'm building up to it, Fran.
You're building up to it.
We can do it next week if you like.
Yeah,
give people a chance to get it right. We have the best beef in Tipperary, so...
If it matters to you, it matters to us. Call TIP today on 1-800-938-007.
And you're very welcome back to TIP today. Now it's time to meet our vet from Ara Vets in Tipperary Town. Mairead is online. Good morning to Mairead.
Morning.
Nice to talk to you today. You know, already we're flooded with questions for you today. So we launch straight in, if that's okay with you.
Okay, yeah, no problem.
Is it necessary to spay a male dog, as they're more prone to fighting, etc.
I'm for neutering any animal, really, to be honest. You know, male or female, it's such a good idea. Male dogs, we always tell people, like, neuter dogs are healthier dogs. Male dogs, if you neuter them, they don't have that testosterone-driven need to, like, go rambling and fighting and getting into trouble. So that is all eliminated. We're also stopping any chance of them having testicular cancer when they get older. Only there, I think maybe 2 or 3 weeks ago, I had to neuter like a 16-year-old terrier that hadn't been done when he was younger, and he had a huge testicular tumor. It was pretty much dragging on the ground as he was walking. Like, you know, you're stopping all that, and you're also reducing the chance of them having prostate cancer when they get older as well. So look, I'm all for neutering your dogs.
Can I ask you a stupid question, though? Does it affect the dog's psyche in some way? I mean, they might be quieter or something, but like, yeah, does it take from them?
I don't think so. My dog Milo's neutered ever since he lifted his leg when he was about 5 months old inside the vet clinic I was working in. I said, that's it. And he went up onto the table on that day and he was neutered, because I couldn't have him in the clinic if he was lifting his leg against every corner.
Of course,
Like, I don't think it changes their personality. I've never met anyone that came back and said to me that they regret neutering their dog. I kind of regret neutering Milo in a way, because I'm like, I just love a pup office. Like, I had someone in yesterday and she has a big Newfoundland cross. And we really recommended neutering to her because they were fighting herself, himself and the other dog. And she came back in and she can't get over the difference. Like she said, he's so much quieter. He's happier to lie down. Mm. You know, the fighting has reduced, you know, by 50%. They still have their odd fight. But look, you're going to have, you know,
of course, yeah.
at least it has reduced.
But and is that because of the testosterone and so on?
Yeah, so they're just trying to be top dog. Like, you know, in a pack situation, you have only one male dog and you have one alpha female. So they're trying to be the top dog. And, you know, in a wolf pack situation, one dog will actually kill the other dog because he wants to be, you know, the leader of the pack. Can only be one male dog. Now, in our domesticated pets, it's not as bad, but they still have that kind of mentality. You know, there is one top dog. So if you're having difficulties with the dog, you pick the one that's, you know, the one that's the lower down in the pecking order, and you neuter him so that you could leave the other one if they're fighting all the time. You could leave the other one unneutered for a while, and he will become the top dog then in that situation.
Isn't it amazing the way that all of that works? Another listener says, when I clean the floors, the surface tops, etc., using bleach, the cats go mad, kind of like they do when you put down catnip. Why is that?
Okay, well, they must like the smell of it, but I wouldn't do it, to be honest. Like, I can't imagine how bleach is good for a cat. I don't know if it's actually that it's driving them crazy and they're trying to get rid of it by rubbing on it or that. I don't know. I can't really recommend to do it anyway, because, like, you know yourself with your eyes and that, if you have bleach anywhere
is very
near
severe,
and
it dries, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, and it dries your hands out and that. So look, I've never heard of that before. I'd probably be more inclined to use catnip or something like that than the bleach.
All right. Another question. We have a male rabbit called Ralph. We're thinking of getting him a companion, but not a female, as two rabbits would be enough. But somebody told me that we would have to get Ralph neutered if we got a second male. Is that true?
Neutering rabbits is a really good idea, especially the male ones. You know, we do them in here quite regularly. Again, with it, you get rid of that bookish behaviour. You know, they're less likely to be scratching, and you just get rid of that testosterone behaviour again, and they become more of a domesticated pet. I would neuter both of them, to be honest. You know, I wouldn't just neuter one of them. Rabbits can bite, and they can be, especially those book rabbits, they can be quite vicious and they can bite and
they can
do things like that with children. Yeah, wow. They can. I'm all for neutering them. Now, being the female rabbit is a little bit more complicated, but like neutering a male rabbit it's not too much, you know, it's not that severe at all on them. There's always a little bit of a risk with an anaesthetic, but that's what any pet. Just make sure you go to someone that has a bit of an experience with putting rabbits under anaesthetic. You know, there's some vets out there that have lots of experience doing it.
Dan is in Templemore and he says, He is a Cocker Spaniel who is never satisfied food-wise, totally dependent on me. He's staring at me all of the time, making me feel guilty. What can I do? Dan is also off the cigars, so his coping mechanism is completely gone at the moment. So what about that? You just can't satisfy the dog.
It sounds like it's a mixture of separation anxiety as well as like that the dog is just constantly begging. So the first thing you need to do is you need to look at the dog's diet and just make sure that he's actually getting enough nutrients. Like, you know, is he being fed enough, and is he being fed a high quality food that's satisfying him? Again, it's like us going down to Supermax and like just having, you know, we're on a diet and we're like, oh, we'll have a small portion of chips and we'll have half a burger, but we're still not satisfied. Like, we'll go home and you'll break into biscuit tin then because you're just still hungry and you want something to eat. It's the same with dogs. If they're not being fed the proper food, he could actually be hungry even though he's eating a lot. That's the first thing I check. Second thing is, it's it could be a behavioural thing. Milo is driving me crazy at the minute, like in the mornings when I'm making lunch and that, because he's just sitting there staring and getting food. And that's because he's got it before and he's waiting for it again. My little fella's just giving him stuff out of his hand and that's all. He'll chase him around, he'll follow him, he'll do everything. Whereas 2 years ago, he would just lie in his bed in the morning while we were having our breakfast. But they learn this behaviour. He's obviously given him a little bit because he's feeling sorry for the dog. So he's given him a little bit and the dog learns that if he gets a bit, he's going to get some more.
It's incredible, isn't it? Yeah.
The best thing to do is just to put him into like another room when you're eating. I know it sounds horrible and he's probably going to go crazy out there, but that's the only way you're going to solve it, I reckon.
I see. But some of those dogs, particularly Spaniels, I think, did you tell me in the past, Mairead, that they don't have any sort of barrier to food? Like, they'll keep eating and eating and eating anyway.
I think most dogs are a bit like that, you know. Cats are a bit different. Like, you can
they'll
put a
know
bowl
when
of food.
They're full.
Yeah, you put a bowl of food down in front of a cat, and most cats will eat enough, and then they'll move on. Whereas a dog, it doesn't matter, you know. If I put tin, like especially the tins of food, in that, you know, if I fed Milo those tins of food, like if I kept opening tins of them in here, he'll just keep looking for it, you know, he'll never stop. And it's the same with kids and Pringles. You know, the Pringles have those MSGs.
Until they get sick or something, yeah.
Yeah, and it's not only kids, it's adults as well. You just want to keep going back for more. It's the salt, it's the sugars, and it doesn't matter if you're full or not. You're like, God, I just want another one, and I want another one. It's the same with the dogs. Whereas if you're feeding them a good quality nut, I do find that they'll eat it and they might leave a little bit in their bowl. But this concerns owners. They're like, oh, my dog doesn't really like the nut. I'm like, no, he's actually just eating till he's satisfied and he's leaving the rest. But I think it's our relationship with the dog. That's how, like, we don't sit down and have a conversation with them. We feed them and we do things like that. And that's what we want, to see them run into their bowl and lavishing into their food and loving their food, because that's the way we bond with them, I'm guessing, you know.
Yeah. Another listener says, the kids want to get a pet, but given the level of responsibility of a puppy, would it be better to get an older dog, say from a rescue centre?
Yeah.
But how can we be sure of its temperament? It's a good question, isn't it?
Yeah, so she's going the right way. You know, they're doing a little bit of research into it. And I love when people take a little bit of time and they don't just go out and buy a puppy. Any animal rescue centre that I know will always help out. You know, like Limerick Animal Welfare, they actually let you walk dogs on a Saturday and a Sunday. You know, you can take them for a walk, the kids can meet them. Their main aim is to find a dog that's going to suit your lifestyle. They don't want a dog coming back to them in 2 months' time because it's too noisy or whatever.
Too big or whatever, yeah.
Too big, it bites the children, it's too active. They don't want that. That's the last thing they want. So they will take a little bit of time with you and with the children, and they'll try and find you a dog that suits. I know people that have gone through Limerick Animal Welfare and they've got a dog and the dog doesn't really work for them, and they'll get them another one and you can try that. You know, they're so good. Whereas if you go and buy a puppy, most of the time, bloody number of the breeder of the puppy doesn't even work after you buy it. You know, they're gone. They don't want to hear about it. Whereas your animal rescue, like, they don't want to be handing over dogs that they've neutered and, you know, vaccinated and looked after really well to find out that it's going to end up in the pound in the next 6 or 7 months. So that's not what they want. They will take time.
Interesting question in here. It says, I asked this a few weeks ago, but our dog is in love with my husband. He'll growl and get very distressed if I go near him. When we're all sitting down on the couch or the table, she just sits and stares at him. I walk her all the time, so it's not like I don't spend time with her. Yeah. But how do I lessen her obsession with my husband? Isn't that interesting?
I would nearly contact someone that's qualified in dog behaviour, you know, if it's at that stage that, you know, somebody else can't go near a person and the dog is growling or is showing aggressive behaviour, I would probably contact a behaviourist to come out and meet you and go through your routine and what happens. And like, it's all back down to basics. Does the dog sleep in its own bed, or does he sleep on the bed with the husband? Does he lie on the couch beside the husband? Things like that. It is really down to that.
But does he see the husband as top dog, maybe?
Yeah, he's relying on him. That's his shadow, and he's relying on him. It goes right back, and even though that she's probably doing the walking and the feeding and all that, he's just looking up to this person as the leader of the pack. I'd probably be inclined to contact a behaviourist about it, because you need to go like right back to the start and their routine, and you know what the dog is allowed to do and what he's not allowed to do. I find like a lot of times that these kind of, I'm not saying it's an aggression problem, but some along those lines, it goes back to the dog being on the couch beside the person. And that's when the most amount of children are bitten, is when a dog is left on the couch and the child either pushes the dog off or pulls him off or something like that. That's when kids get bitten, or an adult, because the dog sees that as their top spot.
Interesting. Ella was on to us to know if fish make good pets and do they require a huge amount of care?
But look, they make good pets, and they teach children about like the responsibility of feeding and cleaning and all that. Obviously, they're not very they're not going to be ones that you can pick up and rub and do things like that. But I think it would be a good starter pet for a child, because they learn, you know, to feed them on a routine and that they need to be cleaned out and all that. And if they're not coping with that, there's no point getting another pet. We always had fish in the house. I like them. I think they're really nice. I think it kind of brightens up a room a bit. They do need care, and they do. A lot of people overfeed fish because that's all they can do with them, is they're feeding, and they like to see the fish coming to the top of the bowl and eating. So you actually don't need to feed a fish that much.
All right, will you take one more for me? My Jack Russell's body is very smelly and it's transferring onto my clothes. Why is that happening?
So if you're getting that kind of a smell off a dog, like a yeasty kind of pungent smell that's transferring onto your hands or your clothes, more than likely they have a yeast infection. It's called Malassezia. If the dog is bitey and itchy and licking its paws and things like that would be another sign of it. They get that kind of, I don't know how to describe it, I suppose a musty smell, and it does go onto your clothes. They probably need a medicated wash. So the best thing to do is to chat to your vet, or a groomer sometimes might be able to give you an idea as well.
Okay, I have to leave you with this one, because Margaret was on to us to say, I wonder if I neutered my husband, would he stay at home for Christmas and stop rambling to the pub?
I'll leave that with them.
Mairead, it's always a pleasure. Thanks very much indeed. Bye. Thank you. That's our vet, Mairead from Arafat's O'Brien Street in Tipperary Town. Neutering the husband. Well, that's one way of doing it.
Join the conversation in Tipperary. Contact us through Facebook, Twitter, or email tiptoday@tipfm.com.
Welcome back to Tip Today. Now, Gifted Contemporary Craft and Design Fair is taking place at Dublin's RDS this week, and there are multiple Tipperary exhibitors taking part. One of them is Alva Gerard from Brookfield Farm Hives Share near Nina, who ditched her job as a London construction project manager to live with over 60,000 bees on a 70-acre sustainable farm. And Alva is joining me online. Now, good morning to you, Alva.
Good morning, Fran. It's great to be online with you. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome indeed. Why did you decide to ditch what some people might see as a wonderful job and come back to the sustainable farm and all your bees?
Well, there's a couple of reasons. One, I loved working in construction, I have to say. It was a fantastic, fantastic fun, and great to see the buildings coming up. But two things happened. One was the crash. I saw that coming. I thought, well, I better find another career. And I'd always been interested in farming, and I wanted to come back to where I was from, Coolbourne, County Tipperary, by the shores of Lough Derg. And so I did. I started farming.
The bees came a little bit later, did they?
That's right, yes. I was lucky enough to use some of the money I'd made in construction to buy a farm. Not a lot of people do that. Mm-hmm. And it was an ex-rental farm, so it took a bit of time to turn it around to look after the soil. And as part of that, I became really interested in the biodiversity and how we can look after soils and all the other animals that, that depend on the land that we think we own, but they think it's for them as well. So there has to be a place for bees and insects and everything else that lives there.
And how did you get into the bees? Because I presume it's something you have to learn about and study and get into the whole science of it.
Absolutely, you're completely right. And I have to say that FIBCA, the Federation of Irish Beekeepers, is a great place to start if you're interested in bees and beekeeping. And I'd always say do a course first, absolutely, because hives are, I mean, each hive has at the height of the summer about 60,000 bees. And they don't all want you to be in poking around in their home. So yeah, you have to be careful. You have to know what you're doing. So I'd say definitely train first before you get into beekeeping.
So now you're into honey and beeswax candles and lots of other things as well.
That's it. The hives produce amazing amount of things you don't think about, because you think about honey first, but they also produce beeswax and propolis and lots of things I'm not even scraping the surface of. I mean, bee venom is used in medicine quite a lot. So there's all sorts of exciting possibilities with hives. But at the moment, I'm sticking to the raw Irish honey from our native black bees, and also making lovely candles the traditional way, hand dipped, hand poured from beeswax, which is a beautiful substance.
It sounds fantastic. And did I read somewhere that those beeswax candles, that they actually cleanse the air as well?
Traditionally, they've been used to purify the air, and traditionally it's been said that asthmatics, if you burn a beeswax candle in a room, that it takes pollutants out of the air, and that's actually shown to happen, a bit like houseplants, that they do take pollutants out and they do purify the air.
I'm intrigued at the work involved as well, Ailva. The harvesting the honey, how often does that happen?
Typically, it happens in the Irish situation in the autumn once a year, maybe about August. If you are lucky enough to be near a bog, some people bring their bees to the heather, and you can get lovely heather honey. I don't do that myself, but a friend of mine does, and it's delicious. But the Irish honey is harvested in August, and it's a lovely multifloral honey. So it's like lots of wildflowers, and I plant about 10 acres of wildflowers on my farm every year. That gives them lots of delicious flowers to eat from.
We're also hearing about the difficulties where the bees are concerned, that we're losing quite a lot of the population. Is that a factor that you have to keep in mind?
Absolutely. I mean, it's not just bees as well. A recent study in Germany showed that in the last 40 years, that they've lost 75% of their insect population.
Wow.
So if you think about that, absolutely shocking. So we need the insects in the same way to feed the food chain, in the same way that plankton is needed in the sea to feed all the other animals. So we really need to look at what's happening with our insects. And the bees are kind of a great indicator species, because we quite understand quite a lot about bees and we like them. And so it's great to get attention on all insects by looking at bees.
I'm also fascinated at the hierarchy where the bees are concerned, and their notion of royalty as well. It's very interesting, isn't it?
It is. There's lots of ladies in the hive. The queen bee, and that's just the name we give her. And you know, until quite recently, people were convinced that the what they thought was the royalty was the king. They couldn't actually understand that the sort of what they saw as being the dominant insect could be female. So there you go.
So we have a lot to learn from the bees.
Well, who knows? Who knows? Who knows?
So tell me what you're presenting then at the wonderful fair that's happening in the RDS, the Gifted Contemporary Craft and Design Fair. Honey, obviously?
Yes, I'm doing this thing called Hive Share. We can get a share at one of our hives. And so we look after the bees, and you get the honey, basically. And it's a great way for people to connect with food production and with beekeeping and honey production. So it's an education as well as being just getting the jars of honey. Of course, you do get the jars of honey, but you also get a gift box at some of our lovely beeswax candles with a certificate saying you've got a share of a beehive. And then we send you newsletters, what's happening to bees in the different seasons. And the farm is an absolutely beautiful place. We're rolling down to the Loch Derg on the Shannon. It's really gorgeous with the wildflowers and trees. And we invite you to the honey celebration every year in August, which is a lovely honey-soaked theme around Bees Day. And then you get your honey.
That sounds lovely. You know, I love your address as well. It's like something out of Enid Blyton, the Brookfield Farm. It's I could see the Secret Seven or the Famous Five hanging around there easily.
That's it. Actually, we do have a lot of open days during the summer, and children are really welcome. We have one particular night called the Wild Child, where kids come and at dusk, and we look out for badgers and look at the stars coming out. That's a lovely evening.
Oh, that sounds beautiful altogether. I'm also interested to read that you were helping to rebuild schools in places like Sri Lanka and Pakistan because there were so many natural disasters in these areas as well. Why did you choose to do that, Ilva?
Well, I've always felt very strongly that when we are in a position to help, that we should. And I had construction project management skills, and it just seemed to be the right thing to do when there was the tsunami disaster in 2004, December 2004, in Sri Lanka. It seemed to be the right thing to go out and use those skills to help rebuild schools. And then in Pakistan, the year after, and there was a terrible earthquake in Kashmir.
Yeah.
And I went out and volunteered again to pass on my skills in project management construction to help local communities put together big construction projects that they would, to rebuild houses that they wouldn't have had the experience of. And I happened to have it. So I thought, well, let's see what we can do.
You must have seen awful poverty and awful situations out there.
Yes. It was definitely, it's very upsetting to see people who've been through losing their entire family. It's absolutely shocking and heartrending. But, you know, if you can help, I don't help, obviously, on the medical side. That's mm-hmm. not my skill. If I come, I'd come in what's called the reconstruction phase, which would typically be 12 weeks after a disaster.
It's very interesting. Listen, it's lovely to talk to you today, and I hope you have a ball and that you do extremely well indeed at the Contemporary Craft and Design Fair. It's running right through the weekend, I think,
yes.
Ava, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It's on today, Thursday, tomorrow, Friday, Saturday and Sunday. And do drop by, because there's lots of our Tipperary stall area. There's lots of Tipperary food producers in the food hall. There's Cross Oak Preserves, there's the Tipperary Kitchen, there's Piedmontese Beef, there's Liz Duff Foods, and there's another one that's popped out of my head.
But, yeah, there's Country Choice, I know, is in there.
Yes, Country Thomas Choice Warren. Is there.
And Cashel Farmhouse Cheesemakers as well.
Yeah, and there's the wonderful Country Choice and the Scullery as well with Flurry Personal. So there's lots of Tipperary people on stalls, and we'll give you a very warm welcome and look forward to
Right. Well, we'd love to visit you at the beautiful Brookfield Farm at some stage or other, and maybe meet the bees as well, who knows, at some point or other.
I'll have a look at the website, brookfield.farm,
and
find out more.
If it matters to you, it matters to us. Call TIP today on 1-800-938-007.
Welcome back to the final portion of TIP today. Trudy is with me. Before we go to the text, we do have a winner.
We do. Margaret in Feathers. I have to say, I loved her comment. Absolutely loved her comment. So she's the winner of our voucher and our Christmas tree there. So keep those kind of comments coming into us, please.
Absolutely. So what else have we got in on text?
A varied variety of issues. Just a couple on the roads. Johnny got in contact and he was wondering those roadworks that were due to be carried on the Slievenamon Road in Thurles, which obviously won't happen now before Christmas. He wonders, where does that funding go? Is it lost? Now, those works don't come under the council's remit. They come under the TII. So I would imagine that money is ring fenced. But if anybody knows any different, they can let us know. Fran, this is from John in Carrick, or James in Carrick, excuse me. I live in Carrick and they tarmacked half the estate and aft when they said and asked them when they were going to finish, and they said that when they were paid for it. So there you go. So basically, they tarmacked half of it and didn't tarmac the other half and won't until they get paid for it. Well, there you go. Mary Daly got in touch. Hi, Fran. Could you find out why Tip General has 40 new beds and no staff? It was crazy there yesterday. Can't fault the staff in the A&E, though. They're absolutely brilliant. And that comes in from Mary.
Of course, staffing is the big issue, isn't it, really, at the end of the day? Yeah.
In relation to carers, so many comments still coming in there. Fran, it was the biggest mistake to close St. Michael's Hospital. Wouldn't it come in for use now? And that's from Mary Dunn. Fran, the same old rubbish about the carers. The carers have no clout at all. The government is the one who needs to take care of the carers. But if the people they mind were in hospitals, it would bring the country to an absolute standstill.
And cost a fortune.
An absolute fortune. Yeah. Then Marion Clay got in touch to say that she's caring for people all her life behind the scenes in rough conditions. No running water, no toilets. She feeds them for herself and she doesn't cost the count. She doesn't count the cost even. She doesn't get anything for it either, but she does it because she feels good about doing it and helping another person. And in regards to the other issue there, Mari, you're very welcome. Then Chrissy got in contact. This was in relation to the prescription charges. She turned 82 on Tuesday, so happy birthday, Chrissy. But she has 12 items of medication. She pays €20 a month. Full stop. She said it's the rule and she doesn't know why Don is having to fork out up to €30. She says that's against the law. It's €2 per item, up to 10 items, and over 10 items there's no charge. So for all her 12 medications she pays €20. So there you go.
So go back to your pharmacist.
Go back to your pharmacist, yeah. Another person got in touch. Somebody lost an engagement ring on the quays in Clonmel around Keogh's fish shop area on Tuesday. The owner, owner for 50 years, they're devastated and reward is being offered on recovery. So if you've spotted an engagement ring along the quays in Clonmel. Another caller says multinationals dictate they control all governments, yet we support these massive vultures every day and they tell you every little counts. Don't blame governments. Take a good look at where you spend your money, and it speaks in all languages. And that's from Martin.
Thanks very much indeed for that, Trudy. And just to remind you that tomorrow we are live from Nina once again. We'll be broadcasting live from the Tip FM Broadcast Centre on Pier Street in Nina. And we're developing a whole kind of a little family situation on Pier Street now, where people are dropping into us and saying hello and indeed taking part in the programme as well. So you're very welcome to do so. And of course, we will have our Friday panel live from Nina too. And that reminds me that if you want to become part of a future panel on a Tip FM, we'd be glad to hear from you. And it doesn't matter what you do or where you are or anything like that. You know, you don't need any particular qualifications. You just might be interested in what's going on in the world and particularly what's going on in Tipperary. So if you want to become part of a future panel, if you want to let us know, you could email tiptoday@tipfm.com. Just give us a contact number and we'll get back to you and we'll chat to you about that. Is that okay? Trudy produced. Owen is on the way and we'll talk to you live from the lovely town of Nina tomorrow. In the meantime, look after yourselves, won't you?